It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're all familiar with the idea of genes being passed vertically from parents to children, but scientists have discovered the genes can move in many more directions, even between species. We'll find out more from the author of the new book, The Tangled Tree. First, a new report from the United Nations lays out the potential consequences if global temperatures rise by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. It's not good. More heat waves, more flooding and bigger snowfalls, higher sea levels, agricultural damage, even the displacement of millions of people. Scientists say keeping global temps from rising that much is a daunting task. In fact, one of the report's authors says it would require unprecedented changes. And we only have, according to the report, a dozen or so years to figure it out. Chris Mooney is an energy and environmental reporter at the Washington Post. He's written books on climate and science. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, we've heard lots of warnings over the years from international groups of science. What stands out to you, Chris, from this particular warning?
Well, they've really looked this time at the near term, not where we're going to be at the end of the century, but what's going to happen in the next couple of decades. And what the researchers have basically said is that there's no sign we're on track, the world is on track to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. We don't even know if we could do it, because it's the kind of transition required would be, quote, unprecedented in human history. But since we're not there yet, it's maybe still possible. That's kind of the verdict.
On the consequences side, before we spend time on what could be done to hold it to that 1.5 degrees Celsius, 1.5 degrees Celsius is still a pretty significant change. A lot could happen with that. What are they worried about if we exceed that level?
Well, it's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, and so that, you know, so it's 1.5 makes it sound maybe a little smaller than it is because it's Celsius, and we're already at 1 Celsius, so 1.8 Fahrenheit, and that's the rise since the late 19th century. So one of the most striking things, there's many, many impacts that scientists are now able to discern. One is that you would be moving into a world where one of the fundamental ecosystems of the planet, coral reefs, they've been likened to the rainforests of the sea. They might basically be almost gone at 1.5 degrees Celsius. So that's pretty striking, an entire ecosystem that is just, you know, kind of defines the tropics, the tropical belt of the whole planet. That's one of the most striking impacts. There are many, many others.
And the risk of the displacement of millions of people. I mean, we hear political stories about immigrants and refugees causing the issue of refugees causing political turmoil in a lot of countries around the world. Climate change could make a lot more of that happen, it sounds like they're saying.
Well, certainly weather extremes will be worse, and so will heat extremes. And that's something that as the temperature increases, these things, your risk of these things increases. In this, you know, we're already seeing it. 1.5C would be worse than where we are now. 2C would be worse than that. And those can be destabilizing in certain regions.
And we saw, going beyond that 2 degrees, we saw this report from the Trump administration that I think you reported on. The Highway Traffic Administration put out a report saying without action, we might see temperatures going up by as much as 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century.
Right. That was an interesting document from Trump administration sort of assessing their rollback or their freezing of the Obama car standards wouldn't really have that much of an impact, although it would lead to more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But because they assume that nobody takes any action, they're therefore able to show that it wouldn't make that much difference because the planet would be warming so much anyway. It was sort of a really interesting intellectual exercise that when we covered it, people were sort of stunned that this administration, which has, of course, moved to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, would nevertheless put down this assumption of very, very extreme climate change.
Talking to Chris Mooney, energy and environmental reporter at the Washington Post, about this new report saying if we don't take very significant action within the next 12 years or so, climate change, temperature increases will go up past that 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold, could cause a lot of problems. Chris, what kind of action does this report say it would take to keep to that 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold?
You have to do everything. So first, there's cutting greenhouse gas emissions. You have to cut them almost in half from their current levels. As we put it in the story, what they're talking about is basically emission reductions every year that would be bigger than the emissions of some of the largest emitting countries on the planet, like Japan or Germany, maybe even India. So that's the scale at which it has to happen, and it's really not clear how that could happen. You have to, and even if you do that, somehow it's not enough because you have to create an entire new industry that will be capable of withdrawing carbon dioxide out of the air. And that really doesn't exist at any scale. But ultimately, that's the reason the scientists' models can say, oh, we can still do this, is that the models create, these models are simulations of the future, they create these technologies, and then they deploy them at large scale, and then with them, we're able to cool the planet down again.
Is this a group that put out this study that's known as particularly alarmist, or that has been kind of jumping up and down, raising red flags?
No, they're the opposite, because this is, they're definitive, and because this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. People may remember they won the Nobel Prize about 10 years ago. So many scientists contribute to this, and then there's actually a negotiation with governments at the end for the language of the summary of the document. So it tends to reflect only the things that everybody in science can agree on. So it's often faulted for being, if anything, a little too conservative. Not alarmist.
Now, you've written in the past about why people in government and elsewhere might not pay attention to reports like this, why reports like this aren't taken seriously. Is there something about this particular report compared to past warnings that you see maybe inspiring governments to take action here?
I think this one's different because of how it's structured. Scientists were asked to answer a different question. They were asked to answer what's going to happen in the next short period of time, 10, 20 years. Usually climate studies, they'll run things out to the end of the century, and it's easy for people to say, oh, that's so far away. But this time they specifically and deliberately studied what's close to us, and that's kind of bracing, and I think that's a little different.
What's been the response to this report since it came out from key stakeholders?
I mean, there's been overwhelming interest in the topic. Certainly, I mean, I think that people are asking us all kind of questions after our story came out. Whether any governments are going to immediately up their ambitions, which is something they're supposed to do as part of the Paris Climate Agreement, and they're supposed to do it in consultation with evidence like this, I haven't seen any signs of that yet. It's very early. It's just a couple days since it's been out. We would look for that to happen in Poland at the end of the year when all the governments get together for their annual meeting to advance the Paris Climate Agreement.
One concern I know from climate researchers has been a sort of fatalism. If it looks like we're going to hit that 1.5 degrees Celsius and go beyond that, people might look and say, okay, well, there's no point in doing anything. Do they make the case also that, well, if we go beyond 1.5, 2 is better than 3, 3 is better than 4?
Well, they say 2 is worse than 1.5. That's the main thing they're saying in this report. So they're trying to, you know, I don't know, they're trying. They're trying to lay out the science, but the effect of it is to try to make people feel not fatalistic, I think, because what it's saying is you really better try to do everything you can to keep it to 1.5, because 2 is way worse than 1.5, and then off you go. The report makes 2 sound almost unthinkable, so 3 would be doubly unthinkable, and so forth and so on.
We'll leave it there for now, Chris. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to talk to you.
That's Chris Mooney, energy and environmental reporter at The Washington Post. We talked to them about the UN's latest warning about climate change and the consequences that lie ahead if action isn't taken. Right now, genealogy research is a big deal. A lot of people want to know more about who came before them, and finding out who your great-great-great-grandparents were was kind of cool. But have you ever stopped to think back further, where the human species even came from and how it fits into the family tree of life? Evolutionary science has given us a pretty good genealogy of the human species and a lot of other species, too. We have a family tree that shows how close we are to other forms of life. But our next guest says recent science shows that things are more complicated than we might have thought, in part because genes have been moving around in unexpected directions. David Quammen is the author of more than 15 books, including his latest, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. David will be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Fest later this week. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Good to talk with you, and I look forward to getting back to Madison.
looking forward to having you in town. Let's start with this basic idea of the tree of life, kind of the metaphor that guides your book and gets more tangled the more we dig into it. Talk a little bit about where this came from.
Well, it's an old idea, an old phrase. I mean, it goes back to the Bible. It goes back to other ancient literature, the tree of life. But beginning with Charles Darwin, it became an evolutionary tree of life, a picture of the history of life on Earth as understood through the evolution of different lineages, beginning with a single source of life and diverging to yield the biological diversity we see on the planet today. That's the classic Darwinian tree of life that, as you said, is now under reconsideration, to put it politely.
Well, one of the ways you look at a few different big stories and the ways we've redrawn that tree, and one is once upon a time we thought there were kind of two basic forms of life, little bacteria dudes and everything else with these more complex cells. And then along comes this idea, well, there's a third thing. Tell us that story.
Right. Along comes this discovery in 1977 by a man named Carl Woese at the University of Illinois in Urbana that there is, in fact, a third kingdom, or as he calls them, domains, a third major domain of life, a group of creatures that had been taken for bacteria, small, single-celled, simple internal structure creatures, microbes, but that when considered under his methods of sequencing genomes, very early genome sequencing, revealed themselves to be not bacteria at all, and in fact more different from bacteria than they are from us, than they are from the limb of the tree of life that includes all complex creatures, animals, plants, fungi, etc. These things are now known as archaea because they're thought to be perhaps related to the oldest forms of life on Earth. But there it was, discovered by Carl Woese, a third kingdom of life. And that was sort of the opening shot in this revolution I described in the book.
And part of that revolution is this new way, this new technology that, say, Charles Darwin wouldn't have had handy for him, where we can read, and we can do it more effectively and cheaply, we can read DNA, dig down to the molecules. Talk about how that's shaking
that's
up the way we do evolution.
That's right. It's this whole new field of science with the fancy name molecular phylogenetics. And essentially what that means is sequencing genomes, sequencing the DNA, and in some cases RNA within living organisms, and then comparing those sequences between different organisms to see who is how closely related to who else and how far back in time the divergences of different lineages go. But in doing that, scientists also started to discover that there were genes moving sideways, not just vertically through the limbs of the tree of life.
Talking to David Quammen about his new book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. He is speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival this Thursday at 6 at the Discovery Building in Madison. Now let's dig into that idea you just dropped on us, David. My understanding of genetics is I get my genes from my parents, and then they get them from their parents, and so on. And that's how I got most of my genes, right? But
right.
There's, they call them in football the lateral, and
yes.
That's happening in the genetic world.
Yes, there is this phenomenon that scientists call horizontal gene transfer. Genes moving sideways across species boundaries, even across boundaries between kingdoms of life. This is supposed to be impossible. I'd written 3 or 4 earlier books on evolution, and I thought I knew a couple of good reasons why it was impossible, but it turns out it is possible. It's not easy. It's not frequent, except among bacteria and archaea. It happens very rampantly among them, genes moving sideways. But it happens also in higher creatures, so that we humans contain some stretches of DNA that have come to us sideways from bacteria and sizable stretches of DNA that have come to us sideways from viruses in the course of viral infections that have gotten into the germline, into the reproductive cells, into the ovaries and testes of humans, and been passed down. 8% of our genomes, we now know, consist of viral DNA acquired sideways.
I want to nail this down here. Somebody along the way could have a virus, pop new genes into them, and they pass them down to their kids. It's not just in a skin cell or something. It actually is passed down to future generations.
That's right. Retroviruses, which insert their DNA into the genomes of the cells they infect. In the case of HIV, they infect immune cells, and we call that AIDS. But if they infect reproductive cells and not just the immune cells in the blood, if they infect eggs and sperm, then they can patch their DNA into the DNA that is passed along to offspring. And that has happened enough times so that our genomes, as I say, now consist of about 8% viral DNA acquired sideways.
Now, as this affects evolution the way Darwin presented it, one way it sounds to me like it could account for more variation, right? Because all we thought of earlier was, okay, genes mutate and then get passed on, the natural selection works on them. This is another mechanism for a species to have new genes to be subject to natural selection, right?
That's exactly right, and that's important. These new discoveries don't overturn Darwin, but they add to Darwinian theory of evolution by revealing that mutation is not the only source of innovation in genomes. It doesn't just happen by incremental changes when DNA copies itself inaccurately by one letter or a few letters. Innovation can also come into a genome in huge lumps, in quanta, in whole genes and stretches, packets of genes, coming in sideways by horizontal gene transfer and providing new innovation, new material on which Darwinian natural selection acts.
You mentioned that bacteria are more prone to do this horizontal stuff, this horizontal gene transfer. For bacteria that cause diseases, is this something that makes them something we worry about more?
This is vastly important when it comes to the matter of disease-causing bacteria, because we now realize that this whole problem that everybody has heard about, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, things like MRSA, these killer bugs that you can't kill with the antibiotics that we have, we now realize that a single strain of bacteria may acquire its resistance to a certain antibiotic gradually by incremental mutation, but once acquired, it can pass the gene for that resistance sideways to a completely different kind of bacterium, from Streptococcus to Staphylococcus, from Staphylococcus to Salmonella. Packets of resistance conferring genes moving sideways instantly from one kind of bacteria into another, and that's why antibiotic resistance has spread around the world so quickly and is now killing tens of thousands of people every year.
All right, that's disturbing. I want to bring things back to the family tree now. It sounds like usually if we did genetic testing of humans, we'd figure out, if we tested most of our genes, we'd find, oh, our cousins, the chimpanzees and orangutans, are pretty close to them, further from other primates and so on down the line. But if we picked a particular gene, it might look like we're closely related to, I don't know, a muskrat or a pumpkin or something, if those particular genes got transferred over?
Or a bacterium? Yes, yes.
It's probably not pumpkin?
Very, very counterintuitive. It's less likely that it's a pumpkin.
Fair.
It's easier for a bacterium to get some DNA into our genome than it is for a pumpkin.
All right, but does this muddy the waters as we're trying to map that family tree out if there's this stray stuff in there?
It absolutely does, and that's why my book is entitled The Tangled Tree. What this reveals is that the shape of the history of life is not just shaped like a tree with limbs and branches diverging, 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 but that in some cases limbs and branches converge, moving sideways. Imagine one branch moving sideways, flowing into another branch and carrying its sap into that other branch. We now realize that that's what the quote-unquote tree of life looks like.
Now, this molecular phylogenetics you're talking about, it's made a lot of discoveries already, but in the world of science, this is pretty new stuff. What are you watching for on the frontiers of this now?
Well, we're learning more and more about now that we have the human genome sequenced, more and more about where all of the DNA, 3.2 billion letters of DNA in our genomes, where it came from. We're learning more about human identity. Of course, we're learning more about issues of human health, but we're also learning about our own deepest history. We're learning that we humans are we think of ourselves as individuals, but in fact we are mosaics. We contain some ancestry from bacteria, some ancestry from viruses, some ancestry, of course, from other primates. So it binds us even more closely to the rest of the natural world. It's humbling, but I think it's also majestic and exhilarating to get this dawning new understanding of our human identities.
In a broader perspective of how we think of science, you mentioned earlier that you've written books that assumed this stuff couldn't happen. Does this kind of reinforce the idea that science is a process? It's not a set of facts memorized from a textbook, but it's this living thing that we're doing all the time?
Absolutely. Science is discovery. Science is hypothesis testing. Science is empirically supported theories, but it's also competition and ambition and insecurity and other moments. It's drinking beer in the corridors of hotels during conferences. That's a very human process, and looking at it, as I try to in this book, reminds us that even the biggest of ideas are works in progress. That's part of the ethic and the ethos of science, that we make these discoveries, we support them, we can count on them, and yet some of them continue to evolve and change.
David, enjoy your visit to Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Much enjoyed talking with you.
That's David Quammen, author of more than 15 books, including his latest. It's called The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. David will be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival on Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Discovery Building in Madison. First, the population of the United States is becoming more diverse every year. According to new data from the U.S. Census Bureau, children born after 2007 will make up the most diverse generation in the nation's history, and it marks the first minority white American generation. Our next guest is here to talk about what these demographic shifts will look like over the next few decades, how the shift will impact our politics and the economy, and what we could learn from the younger generation. William Fry is a senior fellow for the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and the author of Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. William, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, good to be with you, Rob.
Well, I gave a very nutshell description of what's changing. Can you flesh that out a little for us? What are we looking at with this newest generation?
Sure. I mean, this newest generation, which sort of highlighted from the new census release, really is a microcosm of what we're going to become in the next several decades. I call it Generation Z Plus, which is the end point of Generation Z, Generation Z being the generation after the millennial generation, now in their 20s. This Generation Z Plus, I noticed, and I called it that because they're the first generation where every year of that generation are minority white. That means that the white population of that group is less than 50% for all of the ages going from 0 up to age 9. So all the ages under age 10 in the United States now, Z plus, are minority white. Now, you know, that shouldn't be really surprising to a lot of people, because all you have to do is look around in all parts of the country, in the whiter parts of the country, the more diverse parts of the country, the younger kids that you see in playgrounds and in classrooms and everywhere else are much more racially diverse than they had been for decades past. And but what this does is really put an exclamation point on it. And the reason why this is occurring is because the white population in the U.S., the Anglo population, people who identify themselves as white on census forms, is just older. You know, it has a median age right now of 43 among whites, compared to 38, which is the median age of the total U.S. population. But the median age for Latinos is 29, compared to 43 for whites, and for people of two or more races is only 20. So as this older white population is not becoming extinct by any means, it's certainly a big part of the U.S. population, but at the younger ages, most of the growth is occurring among racial and ethnic minorities because they're younger, more women in the childbearing ages. And even though those women don't have lots and lots of children, the fact that they're a younger generation makes them more productive in the younger ages. And, of course, immigration is a piece of it, but certainly not the whole part of why we have this young, diverse population growing up in the U.S. today. And, of course, as that population ages, They're not only going to be under age 10, they're soon going to be teenagers, and then after that, people in the younger working ages, and we need to be ready for them.
Now, some people look at these numbers and are worried about them. White people might fear losing the status as the majority of the population. Some people look at the white population and worry how they're going to react to the loss of that status. You are mostly positive about what's coming out here.
Yes, that's right. My book, Diversity Explosion, I've been accused of writing a positive book about race in America. And the reason is because I think, you know, if you just look at the demography, and I'm a demographer, and, you know, when I write, I have charts and tables, and I talk about all of that. But it's a very kind of slow-going process. You know, this aging of the white population has been occurring for quite a while. Due to lower fertility, not a lot of white immigration to the U.S. I don't think we can expect a lot of white immigration to the U.S. Most of the growing parts of the world are in Latin America and Asia and Africa and other and so forth. As we look ahead, to the extent we are going to have immigration, that's going to continue. And that this younger part of the population, if we are going to grow in the future and not be a country like Japan, which is you know, mega aging in terms of, you know, having an older population, not getting a lot of immigration, not having a high fertility rate. If we're not going to be like that, if we want to continue to grow, we need to embrace this youthful minority population. So, there are people who are concerned about this, and I can understand that. I myself am in my 70s, okay? So I know lots of people my age are concerned that, you know, we're not the America we were in the 1950s or in the 1960s, a largely Anglo country, not a lot of sort of immigrants from those countries that I talked about. But, you know, I think the demography is there to tell us that if we invest in this younger generation, they want to be mainstream, they want to be real Americans, they want to speak English, they want to be part of the middle class. And if we understand that and we invest in these folks, we're going to be in good shape compared to other Western countries, which have a hard time, even a harder time than we do, in accepting immigrants.
Talking to William Fry from the Brookings Institution, author of Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. One point you make is that you want to see us overcome what you call a cultural generation gap. What is that? What can we do about it?
Yes, the cultural generation gap is something I had written about for quite a while because I saw some of the attitudes of the older population, sort of the older, largely white population, being a little bit suspicious about this change that's going on in the younger population. They think that, you know, the country is kind of losing its core values or something because we have people coming in from other parts of the world. And it plays out in an election. And I say I've written about this for quite a while, but it certainly came to the fore in the 2016 presidential election, because I think a lot of the kinds of messages that were coming out as a result of both parties is that one party was sort of shaping their message to this kind of older white population, wanting to make America great again, meaning again, let's move back to a demography of a different time. And then the other candidate, of course, embracing maybe the other part of our population, that younger, more diverse part of the population. And it showed up in the voting patterns to a sharper degree in 2016 than in some of the earlier presidential elections. And we'll see how this shapes up in the midterms coming up in the next few years. And so, I mean, it's kind of the cultural generation gap is not something I thought of as being a political thing necessarily, but just people's natural reactions to change. People have difficulty with change sometimes. And, you know, the idea of my writing and this book is to try to get them to understand that, you know, we need to adapt to this. It's occurring slowly. It's not going to hurt anybody, really. But that's there, and those attitudes are there. And I think, you know, it would be good if people sort of looked at them in a way that we need to embrace each other, these two generations, and not sort of fight with each other.
I want to peek in on a couple other smaller points that you raise in your book, but significant changes. One of them, one of the big demographic stories of the 20th century was this huge migration of African Americans from the mostly rural South to the urban Midwest and North. And now that's in many ways reversing. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, if you look at sort of the broad history of the United States, sometimes between 1910 up until really the mid and late 60s, There's been, a substantial black migration out of the South and into the North. At the turn of the previous century, 1900 or so, about 90% of all the African Americans in the U.S. lived in the South. And, of course, that's consistent with American history. But, you know, over time, the agricultural jobs and so forth in the South kind of drifted away. There was industrialization in a lot of northern cities. People moved into northern cities at that point. But then when we got to about 1970 or so, there started to be a trickle back to the South of a lot of African Americans as the South started to become economically more prosperous and a little bit more open to diversity than it had been for the earlier part of that decade. But it's really now, for the last 25 years, a big, big movement of African Americans moving from those northern states that have been big destinations for blacks, Michigan, Illinois, New York, showing actually a reverse migration, moving back to the South. And although blacks move to all parts of the United States, they're still much more likely to select southern destinations, especially younger blacks, college-educated blacks, or people who, at least with more than a high school education. It's very important for them. And even senior blacks, as they retire, those folks who lived in northern cities, as they're becoming of retirement age, are more likely to move back to the South and to kind of new South states like Georgia and Texas and North Carolina and Florida. They're some of the biggest gainers. But you see, the city of Chicago, in fact, the whole metropolitan area of Chicago, has seen an absolute decline in its black population recently as a result of this black migration back to the South.
Talking to William Fry, Senior Fellow for the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and the author of Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. He's with us to talk about the shifting population demographics in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the U.S. population and how it's changing? What do you think about the role of immigrants in the U.S. economy in the future of the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation about how the United States population will be shifting over the next few decades. According to the U.S. Census, the generation born after 2007 will be the most diverse in U.S. history. William Fry is with us, Senior Fellow for the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the changing demographics of the United States? How do you think it'll impact the country? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hey, thank you. Well, I'm an optimist. I'm one of these aging white guys who's been around since the mid-50s, and I'm pro-immigration. I think it revitalizes the country. I think these people are coming here for the right reason. It makes our democracy stronger, and I am actually very hopeful about the future, and I see good things from a changing demographics, and that's just a statement, and I don't know what you want to do with it, but that's just my opinion.
Bill, thanks for the call. William, a fellow optimist there in demographic terms.
Yeah, and I obviously you and I share the same view of things. If you look at it, I think a lot of people, when they think about immigration, they get the idea that immigrants are people coming into the United States and taking jobs from folks that are already living here. And maybe to some places in some parts of the country, especially maybe 10 or 20 years ago, that was the case and fairly prevalent in some areas. Today, it's less the case. But more importantly, when you think about diversity, which is more than just immigration, because most of the growth in the Latino population in the United States today is no longer from immigration. It's from what demographers call natural increase, the excess of births over deaths. And I talked earlier about that. That has to do with the fact that it's a younger age structure. So these are folks that are here. They're citizens, these young people that we're seeing in our schools. And the aspect of demography that people need to understand, it's the diversity in this country that's the youthful part of the country, of our population. They're the folks that are moving in to the younger ages, to the younger part of the labor force. Over the next 20 years, there's going to be continue to be a huge retirement of baby boomers from the labor force, mostly whites, mostly people my age and probably the caller's age, or perhaps soon the caller's age, who are going to be leaving, and it's going to leave us with a real dearth of folks moving into the kinds of jobs we need to have them take. So what that means is we have the person power here because of not only current immigration, but past immigration, and now second and third generations of some of these minorities. But we need to make the investment in those young people so that they can have the skills to move into middle-class jobs, to knowledge-based jobs, to be able to replace and even maybe upgrade the skills of our labor force after we have these retiring baby booms. So it's an age dimension to this diversity that I think doesn't get across, and that's really where our future lies.
Bill, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Ned in Lake Dubay. Ned, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what did you want to bring up?
Yes, I'd like to know two things. First, is the number one source of immigration to the United States from Asia or from Mexico and Latin America? And the second thing is the immigration rate from Mexico and Latin America greater than the emigration or moving out of the United States back to Mexico and Latin America because of a lot of people not feeling welcome here and leaving the United States for that reason?
Ned, thanks for the call. William, you want to tackle those?
Sure. I mean, that's a very good point to bring up. But what is our current immigration? The Census Bureau came out with new numbers just a couple weeks ago from what something's called the American Community Survey, which tells you how many foreign-born people there are this year compared to other years. And the biggest gains we've had since 2010 in the foreign-born population of the U.S. are people from Asian countries, particularly China and India and the Philippines. There are plenty of people coming in from Latin America, but actually since 2010, in those 7 years, the numbers were only up to 2017, which are the most recent numbers, we actually have a decline of the foreign-born from Mexico. So other Latin American countries are showing gains in the U.S., but a decline from Mexico. So that tells you over the course of, at least the recent history, there are a lot of people moving back to Mexico. And not as many people coming in. Now, the issue, of course, is how much of that is due to the economy, how much is it due to kind of the welcoming message in the U.S. These numbers, again, the recent numbers to 2017, really only overlap just a little bit with the beginning of the Trump administration. So the kinds of messages we're hearing from the Trump administration weren't really resonating yet for these numbers. So there's a lot of economic pulls. A lot of Asian folks come here, come to school to get jobs in various kinds of knowledge-based industries. And also, during this period as well, we had the aftermath of the Great Recession still with us, and those jobs that used to attract a lot of people from Mexico and some of the Latin American countries right across the border weren't there. And so I think part of that little bit of a decline from Mexico has something to do with economic circumstances. So it's not all this kind of necessarily bad image of the United States, although it certainly doesn't help things if we continue to have this kind of, message that you're not welcome here anymore.
Ned, thanks for that call. We're talking to William Fry from the Brookings Institution about growing diversity in the American population. Back to your calls now. Barry is with us in Spring Valley. Barry, hello.
Good afternoon. My question has to do with certainly the demographic changes that relates even to our existing minority populations and the fact that our minority populations have so many of them have lived in poverty. In central cities or major cities, the education has not been as good as it has been for the suburban areas. So what does he see long-term with this large body of less educated people and the implication for ongoing innovation and economic growth, 25 years from now?
Barry, thanks for the call. William, educational disparities for this diverse population.
Well, you know, I think that if you're old, as old as I am, you will call that the $64 million question, because really that is our challenge as a country, to be able to make sure that this next generation, and there are many, I mean, to call them all minorities, as I have done in many places, is oversimplifying it, of course. There are many different groups of coming from Asian origins, some of them very well-educated coming to the U.S., many from South America very well-educated coming to the United States, their parents well-educated, and also, you know, still a substantial African-American population, all of whom, after they're here in the country, do a little better with the next generation. But we still have issues, especially in under-resourced school systems in inner cities. Many of the African-American population and much of the some of the Hispanic population live in that circumstance that really requires some investment, and it does require not only private sector involvement, but it also requires government input, government investment at all levels of government, something we really need to pay attention to. If I had to think of the major goal or the major kind of objective we ought to have for our government going forward domestically, is taking care of this next generation, this very racially diverse generation. They have a lot of potential. They're really our future, and we don't hear as much about it as I think we ought to from officials when they're talking about their plans for the future of this country.
Is that because politicians are looking at an older population, maybe more likely to vote, more on their radar?
You know, I think that's part of it, you know, and it's part of it is this cultural generation gap that some politicians like to sort of play these generations off against each other. And, of course, older people tend to vote at higher rates. We may see that in a few weeks when we see the midterm elections coming up than younger people. And, of course, younger people now more racially diverse as well. And that certainly could be a piece of it. But, you know, if you're a forward-looking politician or a government official running for governor, running for president, running for senator, or even for the local congressional district, you need to educate your citizens about what's going on and how they're going to benefit from a future where you make those kinds of investments. And, you know, I think some of them are like that, and I think those are the people that we really need to listen to.
1 minute left, a little less than now, actually. What would you say to that candidate? What one message would you want them to get out there?
Well, you know, you need to make sure that you're not dividing the folks in your community so that you think you're getting a bigger voter segment by having that division. You need to be someone that's forward-looking, and I think people who make those kinds of decisions to not talk about this is your piece of the pie, we're not going to give the other people their piece of the pie, is the wrong way to go. So, you know, the divisive politics that we're seeing right now, I think demography is a big part of it, and I don't think it needs to be. So I say people should look at my book. They'll find out a lot of reasons why we need to work together.
We'll leave it there, William. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
William Fry is a senior fellow for the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and the author of the book Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Joins today to talk about numbers from the U.S. Census saying that the next generation will be the most diverse in U.S. history, looking at what that means for American demographics, politics, the economy, and more. You can still share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. There are new nominees out for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Those are announced today. Here they are in alphabetical order. Some new nominees, some up again. Def Leppard, Devo, Janet Jackson, John Prine, Kraftwerk, LL Cool J, don't call it a comeback, MC5, the list goes on. Radiohead, Rage Against the Machine, Roxy Music, Rufus featuring Chaka Khan, Stevie Nicks, The Cure, The Zombies, and Todd Rundgren. What do you care? Well, you can vote starting today on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame website. They're going to announce the winners in December and then have a ceremony next year. You know, some people wonder, do you need a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Is it kind of selling out to be part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I think some bands have refused in the past. It is a good conversation starter, though, looking at who belongs there. The criteria, you have to have released your first album, I think, 25 years ago. So you won't see brand new artists getting that nomination quite yet. You'll have to wait for the current pop stars, you know, another 20, 25 years or so. Now, with all of these great artists, I had to play something from one of them, and it's hard to pick just one song. So I decided to go with a song from one of the performers that would make the most people in Wisconsin happy to hear this time of year. It's Todd Rundgren on Central Time.